Conservative? You bet. Controversial? Right again. It's time to squabble on the Jim Benson Show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Jim Benson Show, conservative talk radio covering the issues that concern you here on the BBS Radio Network. If you'd like to call into the show, the phone number is 888-627-6008. Again, that's 888-627-6008. I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving holiday. I certainly enjoyed mine, mostly because it's now an opportunity to get some badly needed rest and get away from the stress and drudgery of work, though I am very grateful to have a decent job and career. Of course, as you know, with our leftist-dominated popular culture and their substantial control of the mainstream media, our educational and other cultural institutions today, Thanksgiving is under attack like never before as a supposedly evil expression of white supremacy, white racism. There is no other kind, you know. White nationalism, and all sorts of other terrible things. According to the arrogant, self-righteous, outrageously hypocritical left, we're, that is, primarily Caucasians, supposed to be just beset with grief and guilt about our nation's evil, racist, oppressor past, and eager to do away with our civilization and culture by surrendering ourselves and our freedoms and individualism to globalism, one world government, transnationalism, or whatever you want to call it. Most Americans are essentially oblivious to all this very dangerous cultural warfare as they go about their busy daily lives, and they, for the most part, still do largely enjoy having the Thanksgiving Day holiday and getting together with their families and friends. Thinking about all this, I'd like to play the audio portion of a YouTube video about the left's attack on Thanksgiving from the New American Magazine. It's called Duke's Take with Dr. Duke Pesta. For those of you who aren't aware, the New American's parent organization is the John Birch Society, which is viewed as a right-wing extremist organization by the left. The John Birch Society was formed, I believe, in the late 1950s and named after an American missionary and military intelligence operative who was executed by the communist Chinese. It was said that he was the first American casualty of the Cold War. Over the years, the society has espoused many strongly conservative and right-wing political views, which you may or may not agree with. But I find the New American has some great insights into the left with its activities and goals today, which are covered up by the leftist-dominated mainstream media, so they can dumb you down and control your thinking. So let's hear Dr. Pesta's views on the left's attack on this longstanding and important American holiday, and you can decide for yourself if Dr. Pesta is some kind of extremist. Please play soundbite one.
I'm Dr. Duke for the New American, and I tell you, Thanksgiving Day is upon us, and it is one of those holidays that I think many people are attacking. Many of the progressives are attacking it. Joy Reid, that lunatic on MSNBC, came out and called it a holiday with questionable origins. That's typical progressive rot, right? The fact that pilgrims and Native Americans sat down together and shared and swapped cultural ideas and technologies, the fact that down the road, the encounters between Europeans and Native Americans would get violent, in no way, shape, or form, Joy Reid, Joyless Reid, has an impact on the significance of the holiday. And the more I teach at the universities, that's my primary job, the more I see this, 4th of July has to go, the holiday, all those fireworks that are reminiscent of bombs going off, this is upsetting to the progressive left. Thanksgiving is upsetting to the progressive left because America became a basically colony of the United States, and that bothers them for all sorts of historical and politically correct reasons. But the more I think about Thanksgiving Day, the more I think it is perhaps one of the more necessary holidays. In fact, it may be the most necessary of the non-religious holidays, non-specifically religious holidays. And the reason I bring that up is because part of my professoriate, as part of one of my jobs at teaching at the university, is I teach Shakespeare. That's my primary thing. And I always am amazed in teaching Shakespeare, the degree to which what he says in his plays 400 years ago are just as relevant and prescient today as they were then. I've been teaching King Lear to one of my senior English classes. And if you ever had a chance to read King Lear, it is probably the single greatest work of art in Western culture that talks about the need for gratitude. The entire premise of the play, of course, is the old king having his daughter. He gives away his kingdom and his daughter to his daughters, and they immediately turn on him. And the entire premise of the play is what happens to society when gratitude goes away. And I had a lecture with my kids the other day at the university, and I pointed this out. Shakespeare does make this really important point. Gratitude, the Christian virtue of being grateful for what you have, for what others have done for you, what your parents, what your civilization, your nation, what they have done for you in allowing you to be free and to pursue life and liberty in the pursuit of happiness. Shakespeare makes it very clear that when gratitude goes away, civilization cannot stand. From that perspective, if you think about it, it's true. Civilizationally, morality can go away, love and sacrifice can go away, humility can go away, but when gratitude goes away, it almost seems like it's the last virtue that is a bulwark between us and chaos. And of course, if you're familiar with King Lear, it ends up in the middle of the play as ingratitude between brother and brother, ingratitude between children and parents, ingratitude across the spectrum, literally drives civilization into to a jungle state, a state of chaos. And you think, apply that today to America. I actually asked my students, where do you learn in school? These are kids who've been in school from the time they were 5-year-old to the time they're 22, 23, seniors and juniors in college. I asked them, where in your public school experience or your university experience have you ever been taught to be grateful? To be grateful for your country? Because on university campuses, being grateful, or another way of phrasing that, giving thanks, Thanksgiving, being grateful to your country is now considered jingoism. It's considered nationalism. It's considered white supremacy. All non-Western cultures, multiculturalists will tell us, have every right to be proud of themselves. Even if their cultures are backward, 14th century, even if their cultures enslave women and kill gays. Nevertheless, non-Western cultures should be very thankful and very happy about their cultural achievements. But it's only Western cultures that are asked not to be. To be grateful to your country, to be grateful to the founding fathers, to the constitutional order, to celebrate Thanksgiving the way we do, we historically have done, giving thanks for our bounty, our blessings, for our nation, for our freedoms and liberties. That's now considered white supremacy. It's now considered toxic nationalism and jingoism. This is highly problematic when my kids could tell me, my university kids couldn't point to anywhere in their public schooling where they actually learned that they had a reason to be grateful. Again, while gratitude is a very important Christian virtue, it's also a civic virtue. So nowhere in their education have they been taught to be patriotic. Have they been taught to love their country? Have they been taught to see the good of their country and not just the bad? And so are we surprised then that our university kids, our young people, see no value in the country, would be happy to transform this country from a free society to a socialist state, that they want to see the First and Second Amendments edited so that hate speech, whatever that means, is not allowed, so that guns were no longer the province of the individual citizen. When we teach kids not to be grateful, we are teaching them hatred. We are teaching them intolerance, and we are teaching them ignorance. Yes, and one of the remarkable achievements that I think we all can be thankful for on this Thanksgiving is the fact that we in the West are not shy about talking about where we've floundered, where we have made mistakes. The irony is that American school kids know more about the legacy of slavery. They know more about oppression, the oppression that Western countries engaged in, than they know about any other aspect of Western culture. They can't tell you anything meaningful about the achievements of Western culture. In fact, when I try to suggest to these kids that their free speech, that their educational opportunities, that the relative wealth that they enjoy, other than, you know, people, 19 and 20 year olds in many countries around the world don't have the luxury of sitting in classrooms. They're working 50, 60 hours a day to work the soil, to feed their families, to find a way to keep life moving, simple basic necessities. But in America, you can be 25 years old and you can be in school since the time you were 5. And never actually had to have a meaningful job. You could be a professional student for the first quarter of your life, and no one thinks twice about it. These things are things that they should be grateful for. We have turned our public schools and our universities into toxically ungrateful places. Our mainstream media sources, our tech giants, our socialist, progressive, Democrat presidential candidates, they harp on the same theme. To be grateful and to love your country is to participate in racism, bigotry, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, the whole litany. But that worldview, as King Lear makes devastatingly clear, is an anti-civilizational worldview. How do you improve your country if you tell people they have nothing to be grateful for? You can't. You can only destroy it. To teach kids to be wary and suspicious of our achievements, and not also to recognize the genius and the liberty and the prosperity it sprung, that is toxic anti-education. It is the opposite of gratitude. It is ingratitude, dangerous ingratitude, which leads to hate, to misunderstanding, and to the kind of cultural rot we see today. And it's not surprising to me that Thanksgiving is actually more in the crosshairs of the progressive atheist socialists than even Christmas is. You think Christmas would really bother them as a federal holiday. But I think they realize that Christmas has been hijacked by Santa Claus, reindeer, and gift giving. So they're not as bothered by that as they are Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is the holiday. It's kind of like second to Columbus Day in holidays they have to do away with. And they've already pretty much done away with Columbus Day. Now they're turning their attention to Thanksgiving. And really at the core of this is a ungrateful refusal to recognize that the greatest critics of Western culture who live in Western countries are allowed to do that without any consequence. American professors, public high school and middle school teachers, mainstream media outlets, they can hate their country, they can be utterly and thoroughly ungrateful to it without consequence. You'd think, wouldn't you, that that would be something to be thankful for? That they can be incredibly myopic, they can be morally obtuse, they can be heart-rendingly ungrateful to the civilization and the culture that allows them to spend their lives, oftentimes tenured at the professorial level, doing nothing more but talking down their country, trashing their country for their students, providing their students with nothing but a one-sided anti-American narrative that ignores the freedom and the liberation. Ask the question, why is it that civil rights, human rights, gay rights, women's rights, social rights have evolved only in the so-called evil Western cultures? You would think that all of those pioneering crusades for human rights, basic civil liberties, would be something that the progressive who hates his country would still find something worthy of thanks. Thanksgiving means that in this country you can hate it. But the more we do that and the more we tolerate that, the more we refuse to show gratitude, the worse civilization turns to chaos. Thank you for joining us on this Thanksgiving. I'm Dr. Duke with the New American Magazine, and this has been my take on the news.
It's not just Americans being thankful for America on Thanksgiving that the left wants to denounce and destroy, but our entire way of life and the nation itself. As I said, few people are really aware of the enormously powerful forces on the left working assiduously to wipe America as we have known it off the face of the earth. The key organization for accomplishing this is the modern-day Democratic Party, with its radical leftist lunatic base closely aligned with communists and other socialists and their elitist globalist allies, and they continue to make headway. While numerous conservative commentators talk blissfully about how strong President Trump's base is and how good his reelection looks, what about the Democratic takeover of the U.S. House of Representatives in 2018? The Democrats also made gains across the nation in picking up seats in Congress and state and local elections. And look what happened in last November in Virginia, which turned all but completely Democrat blue in a Republican political massacre across the state. The mainstream media portrayed this as just another example of Americans rejecting Donald Trump and his policies. But there were powerful, dark, and by that I mean not well-known, forces working behind the scenes to bring about the Democratic takeover of Virginia. The New American had an interesting article by C. Mitchell Shaw on the Virginia Republican debacle, which it ran November 22nd, 2019, just a few days ago. titled Trevor Loudon, and they're referring to another author's work, Trevor Loudon, pro-Chinese communists illegally helped flip Virginia to Democrat control. The article cites excerpts from the author Trevor Loudon on this matter. I wanted to read a few excerpts from that. It starts out, Virginia, known among other nicknames as the birthplace of a nation, has a long history steeped in the pursuit of liberty. Now, with the results of recent elections, Virginia is in the hands of Democrats for the first time since 1993. In fact, Democrats now control both houses of the state legislature, the majority of Virginia's seats in the U.S. Congress, and both seats in the U.S. Senate. This switch from red to blue is a result of years of work by the part of pro-Chinese communists and well-connected fellow travelers. In fact, the co-executive director of a group with pro-Chinese communist connections openly claimed credit for flipping Virginia, stating that the plan for socializing Virginia was, quote, put in motion years ago, unquote. Excuse me. That co-executive director is Tram Nguyen, and her organization is New Virginia Majority, or NVM. Nguyen's boast took the form of a November 6 op-ed piece in the New York Times. Nguyen writes that her organization has spent the past 12 years to, quote, reach voters of all colors, women, low-income workers, and young people where they are, which has made it possible for us to develop a robust base of support along Virginia's so-called urban crescent from Northern Virginia to Hampton Roads, close quote. She goes on to say, quote, long before Election Day, we registered more than 300,000 voters, knocked on more than 2.5 million doors, and organized within communities of color to help win significant policy changes like Medicaid expansion, which covered nearly 400,000 people, close quote. The article continues, so NVM targeted minority neighborhoods, which are statistically lower income neighborhoods, with a pitch for voter registration and an increased voter turnout tied to the promise of more money and benefits from the public till. The result was exactly what they hoped for. Those newly minted low-information voters turned out en masse and placed Virginia squarely in the clutches of the Democrats. The something-for-nothing promises of organizations such as NVM are nothing new. Neither are the consequences that befall those who buy into those promises and vote accordingly, the article continues. It also states, Alexander Fraser Tyler, also known as Lord Woodhousley, 15 October 1747, 5 January 1813, that was his lifespan, I guess, was a Scottish advocate, judge, writer, and historian who served as professor of universal history and Greek and Roman antiquities at the University of Edinburgh. Based on his studies of the histories of democracies, he wrote, a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government, can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public, followed by a dictatorship. I'm sorry, from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. Excuse me. These nations have progressed through the sequence, from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, from selfishness to apathy, from apathy to dependence, from dependence back into bondage. The article continues, the 20th century trend of democracies collapsing under mounting debt only to become dictatorships has proven the wisdom of his observations. Staying close to its Chinese communist roots, NVM is setting America up for jumping out of the frying pan of democracy and into the fire of a tyrannical dictatorship. Nguyen plainly states that her objective in writing about the NVM's successful strategy in Virginia is to, quote, make the case that this type of year-round organizing can pave the way for victory nationally, unquote. And to continue, to refer to NVM as having pro-Chinese communist connections is no exaggeration. As Trevor Loudon revealed in a recent article on the group's activities leading to the Virginia upset, NVM's pedigree includes purebred Maoist elements. Loudon explains that NVM is a front for Liberation Road, known until April this year as Freedom Road Socialist Organization, the United States' most influential Maoist organization. So Freedom Road Socialist Organization, he calls FRSO, and NVM, of course, was we explained earlier. Loudon goes on to write, NVM is led by longtime FRSO Liberation Road cadre John Liss of Alexandria. Several FRSO cadres have served in NVM over the years, as have many activists from two NVM satellite groups, Left Roots and the Virginia Student Power Network. FRSO slash Liberation Road comes out of the militantly pro-Chinese American Maoist student movement of the 1970s. While it's more discreet about its Chinese loyalties these days, several of its leading supporters maintain close ties to the People's Republic. So, John Liss, the other co-executive director of NVM, along with the Wen, is a longtime member of FRSO slash Liberation Road. NVM, then, could be seen either as a sister organization to FRSO slash Liberation Road or as a satellite organization. Either way, they are closely ideological twins. And continuing, Loudon then lists some of the leading supporters as well as their communist credentials. This list includes the likes of Fred Engst, a longtime FRSO supporter who was born in China to parents who moved there in the 1940s, quote, to be part of the communist revolution, unquote. Ernst left China for the United States in the 1970s for his education, but returned to China in 2007. He now teaches at the University of International Business and Economics in Beijing. Another NVM supporter is Alex Tom, whom Loudon explains is a, quote, leader of Left Roots and the pro-Beijing San Francisco-based Chinese Progressive Action. I'm sorry, Chinese Progressive Association. According to Tom's 2013 Left Forum speaker's bio, he formed the China Education and Exposure Program in 2012 to, quote, build a deeper analysis of China for the U.S. progressives and leftists and to build relationships with the grassroots movement in China, unquote. And Steve McClure, another NVM supporter, was, in the 1970s, quote, active in the pro-Mao Revolutionary Student Brigade, close quote. His ties to FRSO and NVM, along with his background of engineering information in surveying, mapping, and remote sensing at Wuhan University in China, where he is a research associate with the state key laboratory in that field, have served the communist cause well. His blog shows that he worked with NVM from his position in China, quote, to make a series of maps to inform planning for perfect walks in Virginia's state house districts, close quote. Those are the maps NVM used to choose the neighborhoods where they knocked on more than 2.5 million doors and registered nearly 300,000 voters with promises of bigger and better government handouts. Roughly 20,000 of those newly minted low-information voters were also felons who had their voting rights restored as a result of NVM's work with former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, who, you may want to know, was a longtime associate of the Clintons and another leader of the Democratic Party. Now, the article continues. Beginning in 2016, McAuliffe announced that he would legally restore the voting rights of more than 200,000 convicted felons. By the time the dust had settled and the smoke cleared, it took him until January 2018 to put nearly 173,000 convicted felons back on the voting rolls. Duane boasted of that success, writing, "The former governor, Terry McAuliffe, restored the voting rights of more than 173,000 Virginians during his term, more than any other governor in Virginia's history. In 2016, of the nearly 200,000 men and women who registered to vote for the first time as a result of the restoration of their rights, a whopping 79% voted. They were a key voting bloc in Virginia, the only southern state that Hillary Clinton won. How many more of these convicted felons were registered to vote as a result of NVM's efforts since 2016 is not known, but it is a safe bet that they were, quote, a key voting bloc, unquote, in flipping Virginia to the Democrats, as Loudon points out in his article, quote, NVM worked closely with McAuliffe to win ex-felon voting rights. The organization actually gave the governor an award at its annual dinner for his sterling work. Well, I can go on with that, but you get the gist of what we're up against here. You may or may not agree with the supposition that Chinese communist Maoists illegally exerted influence in the Virginia elections, but you can certainly draw the conclusion that they were, one way or another, significantly involved. On an earlier show, I discussed the Capital Research Center's article titled Big Money and Dark Shadows, Arabella Advisors half-billion-dollar dark money network. It discusses the hundreds of millions of dollars of so-called dark money being funneled into left-wing causes by a network of organizations founded and run by a former Clinton administration official. The article written by Hayden R. Ludwig of the Capital Research Center, which bills itself as America's investigative think tank, talks about the difficulty in finding out just where the enormous sums of money are being being poured into this left-wing network are coming from. I wanted to, at this time, read a few excerpts from that article. I believe it was from the executive summary here. It states, the line between philanthropy and political advocacy at Arabella is blurry indeed. Most of the projects hosted by the four funds, that's their funding mechanisms, and financed by Arabella's donors, advocate for controversial positions on social issues, for the expansion of government, or both. Yet thanks to the unique financial arrangements of the network and the lack of donor disclosure, it is impossible to trace which organization pays for the various campaigns and political movements spawned by Arabella's funds. Between 2013 and 2017, Arabella Network received a staggering $1.6 billion, that's billion with a B like in Bob, $1.6 billion in contributions, which it has used to advance its donors' agenda through dozens of front groups and AstroTurf initiatives. The Arabella Network funds is also growing rapidly. From 2013 to 2017, the network's revenues grew by an increase and by an incredible 392%. Arabella's network often plays host to highly influential groups on the left. For example, they have used the New Venture Fund and 1630 Fund to host at least 8 projects that don't disclose their original funders. While financial information on the 2018 election year has not been disclosed, the Arabella Network will likely show continued steep revenue growth. Arabella Advisors provides much more to the institutional left than a donor advice. It runs a network of hundreds of front groups. These groups are generally little more than websites created to give the appearance of a full-fledged grassroots organization tackling a niche area, such as protesting Donald Trump's judicial nominees, including Justice Brett Kavanaugh, pushing environmental causes. This is a pet. And, you know, we all know or should know by now that environmental, so-called climate change craze is a big part of the left's causes. It mentions also pushing environmental causes, propping up Obamacare and attacking the Department of Health and Human Services for revoking Obamacare rules that had compelled religious groups to pay for birth control. These front groups are housed in 4 Arabella-controlled sister nonprofits, each of which is profiled here in detail. That's he's talking about the article. Arabella calls its relation to these nonprofits, quote, deep partnerships, close quote. But that's a serious understatement. The 4 nonprofit funds were created by the firm and share interlocking boards of directors and officers, mainly composed of Arabella Advisors' own leadership. Key Arabella advisors work alongside or sit on each of the fund's boards of directors. The report says that Eric Kessler founded Arabella Advisors and currently works as a principal and senior managing director of the firm. Kessler comes from a wealthy Chicago family. Prior to joining the Clinton administration, Kessler was national field director for the League of Conservative Voters, the League of Conservation Voters, a major 501c. That is nonprofit, I believe, environmental advocacy group, which has been described as a, quote, dark money heavyweight, close quote, by the left-leaning Center for Public Integrity. He was later appointed to the Clinton administration to work on conservation issues. According to a biography on the website Friends of the Global Fight, Kessler later served as a member of the Clinton Global Initiative, an arm of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. His official Arabella Advisors biography, however, makes no mention of his affiliation with the scandal-ridden Clinton Foundation. And he put in parentheses a statement that former President Bill Clinton has been criticized by the Washington Post for, quote, intermingling foundation and paid work through millions of dollars of speaking fees paid by companies and organizations that are also major donors to the Clinton Foundation. So as you can see, there are powerful forces working behind the scenes promoting this leftist ideology as mainstream and attempting, and no doubt succeeding to a certain extent at least, we don't know how much at this point, to influence U.S. and other nations' elections and governments. As I pointed out, hate, fraud, and hypocrisy are the stock in trade of the left. Hence, while the Democrats work frantically at painting Donald Trump as engaging in possibly treasonous collusion with Russia, Ukraine, and who knows who else, to supposedly undermine American representative democracy and influence elections for the right, there's a lot of evidence pointing to the Democrats doing similar things. But that's how the left works. Propagandize, confuse, brainwash, influence the thinking of the masses to believe the right is guilty of what the left is actually doing. And if people believe it, that's all that matters. Remember the old adage, tell a lie often enough and people will believe it. As another example of this fraud and hypocrisy, let's hear an audio clip from Fox's Swamp Watch program with Steve Hilton about Joe Biden and his son's doings in the Ukraine. Biden has claimed that all the major media organizations have declared he's done nothing wrong. Like I said, propagandize, confuse, brainwash, and influence. How many millions of gullible Americans go along with all this? Please play soundbite 2.
At the heart of this story is natural gas. Countries like Ukraine and Russia, they're totally dependent on their energy industries. In fact, Russia was once described as a gas station with nuclear weapons. Republicans for many years have argued that we in America should boost our own energy production, for example, through fracking, to make us and the world less dependent on gas from unstable and somewhat unsavory regimes like Russia and Ukraine. Joe Biden totally disagrees. Here he was at a CNN climate town hall recently.
I've argued against any more oil drilling or gas drilling on federal lands that we can and stop that.
Yeah, stop that. No more gas. Gas, really bad. It's funny then that just a few years ago, soon after President Obama made Biden his point person on Ukraine after Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, Biden pushed Ukraine to boost natural gas production, even offering American tax dollars to help them do it.
Imagine where you'd be today if you were able to tell Russia, keep your gas. It would be a very different world.
Indeed. And now I want you to pay close attention to the timeline I'm about to show you. In early 2014, someone called Devon Archer, who was the longtime business partner of Joe Biden's son, Hunter, joined the board of Ukraine's largest gas company, Burisma. On April the 16th, 2014, Archer had a private meeting with Vice President Biden at the White House late into the night, according to White House records. 2 days after their meeting, on April the 18th, Hunter Biden joined the Burisma board too. And 3 days after that, on April the 21st, Biden went to Ukraine with a promise of over $1 billion of U.S. taxpayer aid to the Ukrainian gas industry. Unbelievable coincidences, right? In case anyone thinks this is some crazy Fox News, Peter Schweitzer, John Solomon conspiracy theory, let's just use the words of the Washington Post in a commendably pithy headline. As Vice President, Biden said Ukraine should increase gas production. Then his son got a job with a Ukrainian gas company. Of all the companies in all the countries in the world, Biden's son joined the board of the one company that would most benefit from his father's offer of billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer cash in the one country where his dad was acting like some kind of imperial consul whose word was basically law. Just a coincidence. And there's no conflict of interest because...
I've never spoken to my son about his overseas business.
Really? That's not what he says. In an interview with The New Yorker, Hunter Biden says he did tell his father about his work with Burisma. And Joe replied, I hope you know what you are doing. And then, look at this photo. Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and Devon Archer golfing together in August 2014. To be clear, that is the then vice president golfing with two board members of Ukraine's largest gas company while he was presiding over billions of dollars of US aid going to the Ukrainian gas industry. It's fine. Just a nice family outing. Burisma reportedly paid Hunter Biden over $50,000 a month, despite him having no experience in the Ukrainian energy sector or any energy sector. Democrats are fine with that. Here's Congressman Ted Lieu.
The underlying problem here was, of course, Hunter Biden receiving $50,000 a month from a Ukrainian energy company. Do you think that that is evidence of corrupt behavior?
No. People sit on boards and they get monetary payments.
Sounds to me like swampy Ted Lieu is preparing the ground for when he sits on boards and gets monetary payments after he leaves Congress and cashes in. But actually, 50 grand a month for Hunter Biden turned out to be great value for Burisma. The company was founded by a shady character called Mykola Slokhevsky, who abused his time in the Ukraine government to hand out gas licenses from which Burisma would end up profiting. By 2015, Slokhevsky found himself under investigation for abuse of power, embezzlement and other charges. He may even have faced justice if it weren't for Hunter Biden's Burisma board seat, signaling to Ukrainian prosecutors that Slokhevsky had the backing of the American vice president, who was calling the shots in Ukraine. Incredibly, Slokhevsky got off scot-free. But Hunter Biden's connections still had more to offer. Remember Devon Archer, Hunter Biden's business partner, also on the Burisma board? He had previously been the top fundraiser for, drumroll, John Kerry, who was Secretary of State at this time. Soon after Devon Archer and Hunter Biden joined the Burisma board, the company channeled $90,000 to a lobbying firm called ML Strategies, which was headed by, guess who? David Leiter, John Kerry's former chief of staff. Leiter personally lobbied in Washington on Burisma's behalf. That's handy because then Secretary of State John Kerry himself had visited Ukraine with promises of U.S. aid and assistance. Also handy, connections with Democrat senators.
Also on previous shows, we've discussed the growing presence and influence of Communist China in the U.S. We just gave some examples of it here, but there's more. For years, the Chi-Coms have been establishing, with their money, an influential presence in Hollywood and on college and university campuses through their Confucius Institutes. For example, pressuring U.S. companies and organizations with interests in China to keep quiet about and even support communist interests, such as exerting more influence over semi-autonomous Hong Kong and promoting the annexation of Taiwan. Think I'm engaging in overstatement here? Well, let's look at a couple of articles by that bastion of socialist thinking, the Washington Post, which occasionally does run things which show another side to their view of the world. There was an article the Post published on September 24, 2016, titled China's Influence Over Hollywood Grows, by Anna Swanson, one of their reporters. It states, China has never been shy about its desire to acquire, quote, soft power, unquote, the kind of cultural and economic influence that can't be wielded by military might. And Hollywood has often been a partner in its project. China's bid for soft power was on show this week as Sony Pictures Entertainment formed an alliance with Dalian Wanda, a Chinese company that has become one of the world's largest media empires. In a deal announced Friday, that is referring to this article, which was published in late September 2016. While the partnership was smaller than some of Dalian Wanda's previous acquisitions, it attracted attention as the Chinese company's third major deal in Hollywood this year. That's just in 2016, mind you. These deals have sparked concern over whether China's expanding influence in Hollywood could lead to more pro-Chinese propaganda in U.S. films. The Chinese government tightly controls media content, and Hollywood studios have been known to alter films to feature China or the Chinese government in a more flattering light to gain access to the country's lucrative film market. Now, there's another article from the Post. Actually, this was an opinion column, apparently. This was published February 18th on 2018, and it's by Josh Rogan, one of their columnists. It says, waking up to China's infiltration of American colleges. And it states, China's massive foreign influence campaign in the United States takes a long view, sowing seeds in American institutions meant to blossom over years or even decades. That's why the problem of Chinese financial infusions into the U.S. higher education is so difficult to grasp and so crucial to combat. At last, the community of U.S. officials, lawmakers, and academics focused on resisting Chinese efforts to subvert free societies is beginning to respond to Beijing's presence on American campuses. One part of that is compelling public and private universities to reconsider hosting Confucius Institutes, the Chinese government-sponsored outposts of culture and language training. With more than 100 universities in the United States now in direct partnership with the Chinese government through Confucius Institutes, the U.S. intelligence community is warning about their potential as spying outposts. But the more important challenge is the threat the institutes pose to the ability of the next generation of American leaders to learn, think, and speak about the realities in China and the true nature of the Communist Party regime. Quote, their goal is to exploit America's academic freedoms to instill in the minds of future leaders a pro-China viewpoint, close quote, said Senator Marco Rubio, R. Florida, co-chair of the Congressional Executive Commission on China. Quote, it's smart. It's a long-term patient approach, close quote. And the article continues, this month, Rubio asked all Florida educational institutions that host Confucius Institutes to reconsider those arrangements in light of a growing body of evidence that China seeks to constrain criticism on American campuses, exert influence over curriculum related to China, and monitor Chinese students in the United States. So as you can see, I'm not exaggerating when I say the Chinese communist regime is very involved in influencing America in any way it can. Does anyone doubt that the People's Republic of China has a big stake in eliminating, or at least diminishing, the political power of Donald Trump, who has sought to reduce China's very favorable trade status with the U.S., status that has made many U.S. corporations rich along the way as well, but which also has impoverished much of the American middle class by replacing their jobs and production with near-slave labor in China? All this is why I can't feel positive about the prospects for Trump and the Republicans in the upcoming 2020 elections. Given the enormously powerful globalist, communist, and so-called liberal forces arrayed against Trump and his base, we certainly have our work cut out for us. What I'm concerned about is Trump may be able to hold on to his base, but we need to expand that base. If the Democrats are going to continue to hold the House, maybe gain influence, even gain seats in it, then Trump is going to have a much more difficult time in trying to accomplish his goals and his agenda. Speaking of the left's attempts to turn more Americans against Trump, let's hear about the rabidly anti-Trump media's latest trick, that Trump supporters are actually a cult. Let's hear Greg Gutfeld on Fox's The Five program talking about this latest hysterical propaganda ploy. You're going to hear a number of audio clips from left-wing commentator Brian Stelter and his program Reliable Sources and others on CNN, also known as the Communist News Network and the Clinton News Network. In any event, you don't find much more obsessive Trump hate than on CNN. Please play soundbite 3.
When you're in the media and out of ideas, you resort to the smear. And when the smear of a leader doesn't provide you with that dopamine hit, you expand your attack to include anyone who supports the guy you want to hammer. Remember the deplorables, a word meant to describe 60 million people? Well, now we got a new one. Hey, everyone, those Trump supporters, they sure seem like a cult, don't they?
The word cult has been popping up more and more. Think back to 2 weeks ago on this program, Anthony Scaramucci talked about his claim that Trump supporters are in a cult. Just last week, Dan Rather said he thinks support for Trump seems increasingly cultish. And this weekend in the Washington Post, Trump critic and Republican strategist John Weaver said the GOP is not a party anymore in the traditional sense. It's a cult.
So nearly half the country is a cult. That's weird. We'll call it America. In that cult, people believe in free thinking, truth, and justice. It's their way. I mean, usually a cult is defined as a smaller, extreme group that demands allegiance and secrecy, kind of like CNN. But now to that network, it encompasses everyone who doesn't watch CNN, i.e. nearly all of America, who must plug their ears at the airport bar to avoid Don Lemon's whining. But Trump's in good company. The cult smear is what political losers embrace when they can't explain to themselves why they're still losing. Many leaders have supporters who are passionate, but also feed off the relentless negativity of the press. I know I do. Need I remind you that over 90% of Trump's media coverage is hysterically against him? It's lockstep journalism, one that demands adherence. If it were only obvious.
It is almost like a dear leader situation. It's like a cult of personality.
Cultish devotion.
Part of the cult.
The destructive cult.
You say the president is using mind control.
Become a cult.
View yourself or in a cult.
That's a cult. It is frightening to hear a cult expert say that you see all these signs right now, today, in American politics.
What's that sound like, Mr. Stelter, our non-Hare Krishna? Looks like your programming could use some deprogramming.
And this meme, this narrative that Trump is using some kind of mind control and his supporters are a cult, is becoming more widespread, as you just heard, through the mainstream media these days. Aren't you ashamed of yourselves? And of course, as Gutfeld pointed out, isn't this exactly what the left is doing? And their influence over millions of brainwashed, brain-dead ninnies out there who buy into this stuff is frightening. But like I said, while people like Gutfeld talk blithely about how the left supposedly keeps losing, I'm very, very worried about the left's successes. The Democratic takeover of the U.S. House of Representatives in 2018 and pretty much all of major state and national political representatives in Virginia last November as a couple of key examples. If Trump and his supporters are going to win next year, to really win, they've got to expose and defeat the very powerful, fabulously well-funded, and secretive forces working diligently toward their defeat and getting their message out to voters, to the legitimate voters, in the 2020 election. If we don't pick up seats in the House and retake it, we're just going to have a repeat of these last few years of endless attempts to destroy Trump and turn the country back towards its march towards socialism. Trump has caused the creatures to jump out of the swamp and openly embrace a lot of socialist ideals, which they were trying to soft pedal before this. But the problem is, how many people go along with this? If many didn't, why would they have been able to take over the House of Representatives and flip Virginia almost completely blue last November? Well, like I said, we certainly got our work cut out for us. I have some ideas about doing this. I think we have to have a much bigger media presence. I'd like to see the GOP putting out documentaries about this stuff to get the word out to the public and spread it across the internet and everywhere else they can get it. We could use a new television network. Although there are a couple of pretty good ones, One American News Network, for example. We have Newsmax TV. But how many people overall out there are watching these compared to those who pay attention to CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, and MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, on and on it goes. Anyway, that's it for another show. As always, I hope you found what we had to say of interest. Join us again 2 weeks from today in the same time slot. Hope you have a good evening.